have to maximize the time tonight. So Erev Tov, welcome to the President and the Jews, Part 23, sponsored as always by Becky Navikatz, Ilui Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. By mentions the last of the season. We'll pick up the other presidents next year. Today is D-Day, we should make note of it, June 6th, the 72nd anniversary of the invasion of Europe, D-Day. Oh, I have in my folder the brochure they handed at Pointe du Hoc, which the Army Rangers scaled. Also amazing how anybody survived that. The three transformative presidents in the 20th century, presidents who redefined the office, the government, and or the country. So Woodrow Wilson made the chief executive the most powerful office in the land, the one elected official who represented the entire country and so could implement policies that affected the entire nation. Franklin Roosevelt, who built on Wilson and expanded government into areas of personal life that were theretofore unimaginable, dominating the economy and becoming almost a father figure to the people. And then Ronald Reagan, who sought to undo much of what FDR did by using the office as Wilson construed it. So he wasn't entirely successful. By Reagan's time, the government was too large to reverse and the people too fragmented into interest groups to even desire a, so to speak, small government. What people want today is that government should take money from them and give it to us. And the only argument is, who's the them and who's the us? But Reagan tried, and to a large measure succeeded, in slightly bending downward the arc of government expansion. But he did succeed even more in reviving the American dream, in reawakening the hope and promise of American life, and in injecting back into the American bloodstream what had been the traditional values of the U.S. before the 1960s. So he began a conservative revolution that has dominated politics until just recently. And more importantly for America, he quieted the talk that had arisen during the failed Carter presidency that perhaps the job is too big for one person in the modern world and there needs to be a council to run the country. Reagan showed that one person with ideas, with values, with grit and optimism can lead. And he articulated a vision of America that was so appealing, or appealing to some, and unappealing to others, that the U.S. has essentially been divided ever since between Reaganites and non-Reaganites. So divided that Reagan was the last president to win a landslide in 1984. If his successor and Vice President George H.W. Bush came to office experienced, having served in a wide variety of positions in government, what we'd call more traditional route to the presidency, the resume collector, Ronald Reagan was assuredly not. Few thought he could be president or should be president, given his Hollywood background, but his greatest asset was that he was the unpolitician. And think of how it relates to this year as well. The unpolitician who gently mocked the political class, or there's nothing gentle this year. The non-politician running this year is Ronald Reagan, without the optimism, or the smile, or the sweetness, and the humility, which is to say, he's not Ronald Reagan at all. But who's to say the country, as currently constituted, deserves another Ronald Reagan? Bush ran as Reagan's third term, in essence, and won, but despite his experience in government and his own personal qualities, he too was a humble and decent person. He lacked Reagan's natural warmth, lacked Reagan's suave articulation, and certainly people skills, and he paid a price for it. So how did such a man as Ronald Reagan become president? For an upholder of traditional values, Reagan remains the only divorced person ever to be elected president. He could be a very distant father. And he was the oldest person ever elected president. He was 69, even older when he took office than William Henry Harrison. But bear in mind, the two front runners today would be the same age as Reagan if they were elected. And the third, Sanders, is much, much older than that. But what made Ronald Reagan special Whereas Midos, his humility was genuine, his love of people was real, and he was without any airs. Ron Kessler writes in his book on the Secret Service that no president was more beloved by the agents than was Ronald Reagan. He never failed to greet every agent, to make conversation with them on Air Force One, to have agents dine with him in the White House, rather than just perceive them as hired help. Reagan, it said, never entered Air Force One without first sticking his head into the cockpit and saying hello to the pilots, and never left Air Force One without thanking them. It's a tremendous contrast with Carter, whom the agent said did that exactly once during his term and didn't want the agents even talking to him. People noticed that. People noticed other things we wouldn't know, only later we found out. Reagan would always fly to his ranch December 26th. Why? So his agents can spend December 25th with their families. He stayed in the White House where there was a set group. It was the right thing to do. George Bush, Bush 41, did exactly the same. And the agent said he was that person who was exactly the same in private as he was in public. Humorous, laid back, friendly, and genuinely interested in people. It's interesting, Reagan would sometimes carry a pistol with him. In fact, when he met Gorbachev for the first time, the only thing he had in his briefcase was a pistol, and he had said early on to the Secret Service, if you guys can't do the job, I can help out. And, you know, he had played, I guess, gun-toting roles in the past. Great leaders are people who have a few big ideas and the capacity to execute them, and Ronald Reagan did. He had a few big ideas: small government, free enterprise, anti-communism, strong military, pro-freedom, self-help, personal responsibility. Reagan also had a great sense of humor, which was often self-deprecating, and with him quite natural. Famous quotes, you know, he's always mocked for his work ethic. Reagan said, "It's true, hard work never killed anybody, but I figured, why take a chance?" Or he said, I never drink coffee at lunch. I find it keeps me awake for the afternoon." Now, some of these were spontaneous, some were planned. Famously, this was actually planned, after the first presidential debate in 1984, he looked a little old and a little befuddled. At the time, he was 73. He was asked about his age at the beginning of the second debate, and he responded famously, "I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I'm not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience." Now, his opponent, Walter Mondale, later wrote that he knew right then he had lost the election. So how was such a man produced, and how did he relate to the Jewish people? Ronald Reagan was a person who transcended his roots but never forgot them. He was born February 6, 1911 in Tampico, Illinois, into a poor family. His father was a salesman but also an alcoholic. Reagan adored his mother. As president, he never forgot them. Again, it wasn't known until much later. He would answer letters from people and send them checks, sometimes for $4,000, $5,000. No publicity sought, none received. He would even use Air Force One to deliver children who needed kidney transplants. And he only told the agents, "Don't tell people, I was poor myself." He worked his way through school, graduating from Eureka College, and held a series of jobs: lifeguard, circus performer — that itself prepared him for the presidency — radio announcer. He would broadcast Cubs games by improvising play-by-play off the teletype. 1937, he took a screen test, was signed by Warner Brothers. Some of his films and performances were better than others. He played a variety of roles, but he learned the power of communication and acting. He was later asked, in fact, this is a conversation he had also with Menachem Begin, "How can an actor be a president?" And Reagan responded, "How can a president not be an actor?" So he acted in more than 50 movies, only one with Nancy Davis, who later became his second wife. During the war, he served stateside. He had bad eyesight, but his army service over 3 years took him out of Hollywood, and his career never really recovered. So in 1947, he became the president of the Screen Actors Guild. ironically, the only president ever to serve as head of a labor union. Ironic, because he was the one who put to death the Air Traffic Controllers Union. And in that position, as head of the SAG, he began to move away from the Democrat Party. Reagan was an FDR Democrat, even supported Helen Gehagen against Richard Nixon, but he saw the communist influence in Hollywood, and he saw also the slow government creep into people's lives and into commerce. And by the late 1950s, he was a Republican, officially joining the party in 1962. As he put it, "I never left the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party left me." He kept himself in the public eye in the 50s into the 60s by hosting General Electric Theater on television. Some of you may have seen it. And so he had what today we call name recognition. People always knew who he was. He was interested in politics since the late 1940s, but his big boost came in 1964, a televised speech in support of Barry Goldwater a week before the election, called "A Time for Choosing." Essentially a choice that he laid out between the creeping totalitarianism of big government and freedom. And he said, "The founding fathers knew a government can't control the economy without controlling people. Man's age-old dream, the maximum of individual freedom consistent with order." And this struck a chord with listeners and party poobahs. And not just because of the substance, but the delivery as well was flawless. And 2 years later, Reagan was drafted to run for governor of California. He won in an upset, and although campaigning as an ideologue, he really governed as a pragmatist, and he was easily reelected in 1970. But both in 1968 and 1976, he ran for president in the Republican primaries. In 76, as we discussed last time, he came very close to unseating Gerald Ford for the Republican nomination. Now, Reagan always had his detractors, even in the party, not to mention outside the party. People who thought he was unintelligent, who thought he was an actor reading lines written by someone else. Campaign memo in 1980 stated that his opponents would try to portray him as the three D's: dumb, dangerous, and deceptive. In fact, that's what Carter did. And in truth, Reagan may not have been the most intellectually gifted president, but he cultivated the image of a dunce, and he used it to his advantage. And he assumed correctly that people would underestimate him, and they routinely did. The fact is, he was not at all unintelligent. Indeed, in the late 70s, I remember hearing some of these, Reagan delivered daily radio commentaries on the issues of the day. And we only know this now because it was all published in the late 90s, early 2000s. He personally wrote out each one in longhand. And on every possible issue, he wasn't reading someone else's words. He was reading his own words. He never gave a speech, even as president, in which he didn't review, edit, and insert his own language, thoughts, and style. But he played to the advantage that people thought, his adversaries thought, he was ignorant. Now, Reagan had a relationship with Jews, of course, going back to Hollywood. It was an industry dominated, heavily dominated by Jews, Warner Brothers, MGM, etc. He had a lifelong relationship, a friendship with Walter Annenberg, who's a Jew who's completely assimilated. Well, he did marry Jews. But Reagan did not have a prejudice bone in his body, not against Jews, against blacks, or any minority group, nor did his mother for that matter. So he was, the story's told that as a teenager, when he was a lifeguard or working somewhere, he brought home a few blacks whom the local hotel in Dixon, Illinois had refused to serve. And they stayed overnight, and his mother fed him. It was very natural to him. And his support for Israel was deep and long-standing. As governor, he spoke at rallies during the Six-Day War, and in 1971, California became the first state that authorized its banks to invest in Israel bonds. That was all Reagan. In the late 1970s, as he prepared for a successful presidential campaign, he surrounded himself with pro-Israel advisors like Elliot Abrams. Richard Pearl, Richard Pipes, all these people still around today. And even later, he induced a strong pro-Israel Democrat named Jean Kirkpatrick to become his UN ambassador. And the neocons, then a new movement, coalesced around Reagan, Norman Podhoretz, Irving Kristol, and others. Like many other issues, his support for Israel was simple and heartfelt, and it came out before and during his presidency. He perceived Israel in his terms as a major strategic asset of the United States. He was the first president to use that formulation, seeing Israel not as a dependent, as previous presidents had, but as an asset. As, I quote again, the only stable democracy we can rely on in a spot where Armageddon could come. And Reagan was also a believing Christian, even though he wasn't a regular churchgoer, but he saw himself as God's servant, and things like Armageddon and the apocalypse were very real to him. And he refers to it consistently in his diaries. Reagan was the natural choice of the Republicans in 1980, and despite some early troubles, he won 44 state primaries to the 6 won by the runner-up, George H.W. Bush, whom Reagan then nominated to be his vice president, and this after party elders tried to convince Reagan to nominate Gerald Ford as sort of a co-president. So little do they trust his ability to do the job if he was even able to defeat an incumbent, though unpopular, president. In the critical debate, he looked at Jimmy Carter and said to the audience, "Ask yourselves, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? If you are, vote for my opponent." But most Americans were not, and the hapless Carter had no response, and when he lost, after he lost, he always remained bitter. Reagan, during the campaign, also criticized Carter for not supporting Israel at the UN and allowing a resolution criticizing Israel for proclaiming Yerushalayim its capital. Reagan, I quote, "Jerusalem is now and should continue to be undivided. An undivided city of Jerusalem means sovereignty of Israel over the city." And he lambasted Carter for declaring Israeli settlements illegal, a formulation that Reagan never used while he was president. Reagan won handily, despite a third party run by a liberal Republican, John Anderson. He ran with this slogan, get this, "Make America Great Again." Where have we heard that recently? But that was his slogan, if I have it on a coffee cup, as Reagan's slogan. He defeated Carter 51-41%, but 489-49 in the Electoral College. Jews, being Jews, supported Carter over Reagan by 45-39%. But no Democrat had ever received a smaller share of the Jewish vote, and no Republican since Ronald Reagan has received even his 39% share in 1980. And 1980 was the first year in which Orthodox Jews overwhelmingly supported the Republican. Reagan had several goals: to revive the economy by cutting taxes, breaking the spiral of inflation, reducing government, deregulating, rebuilding the military, restoring patriotism and optimism, and defeating communism. Now, the latter was anathema to the Nixon-Kissinger crowd who favored détente, accommodation. Reagan, I quote, "My policy towards communism is simple. We win, they lose." Who would have thought that by the time he left office, Soviet communism would be on the verge of collapse? Reagan's tenure in office was almost aborted when he was shot on March 30th, 1981, by a nut, John Hinckley Jr. It wasn't clear at first that he was even shot. He thought the Secret Service agent had broken his ribs, but when he coughed up blood, he was taken to the hospital. He walked in under his own power and then collapsed. And years later, only do we find out the truth. The fact is, he was near death when he collapsed in the hospital. At one point, the doctors could get no pulse. The bullet had collapsed his left lung, was lodged an inch from his heart. He lost half the blood in his body, and he survived with transfusions until they could locate the bullet. He needed two surgeries, but everyone remembers the jokes he told before surgery once he regained consciousness. To Nancy, came to the hospital, "Honey, I forgot to duck," which was an old movie line to his three aides who came to the hospital to see him. Baker, Deaver, if you're all here, who's minding the store? To the surgeon, please tell me you're a Republican. One of the surgeons was a Jew, one not, and that one famously said, Mr. President, we're all Republicans today. After the surgery, a day later, he came to, and one of his aides came to the hospital and said, everything in the White House is functioning smoothly without you. So Reagan said, and that's supposed to make me feel better? He was the first president to be shot and to stay alive. Think about it. He spent 2 weeks in the hospital after suffering several setbacks, infections, but he survived. And he wrote in his diary that God was giving him another opportunity. His popularity soared, and within a few months, his domestic agenda, including cutting the top tax rate eventually from an obscene 70% to 28%, passed. When Carter left office, inflation was 12.5%. When Reagan left office, 4.4%. Real GDP growth averaged 3.4% during Reagan's 8 years, a mark that's not been reached even once in the Obama non-recovering, with a staggering GDP growth rate of 8.6% in 1983. So Reagan's economy boomed, government revenues increased substantially, as supply-siders predicted, but the deficit also soared as Reagan used the increased revenue to rebuild the military, but also to placate the Democrats in Congress with more domestic spending. Now, Reagan had no Jewish cabinet secretaries, but he did have many Jewish advisors, including Milton Friedman and other appointees, including Ronald Lauder. He nominated Douglas Ginsburg for the Supreme Court after Ted Kennedy and others trashed Robert Bork, but Ginsburg withdrew his nomination after it was revealed that he was a marijuana smoker at Harvard. Today, people don't care about those things. Reagan's support for Israel was visceral, but that's not to say it was without any hiccups. In truth, Reagan clashed with Menachem Begin several times. But in retrospect, all the disputes were natural and expected. After all, the U.S. and Israel are two separate countries. And although their interests usually converge, it would be foolish and immature to think they always do. And often Jews are quick to criticize when we realize that American interests and Israeli interests are not always identical, and when an American president operates in an American interest. So the first confrontation came when Israel destroyed Iraq's nuclear reactor June 7, 1981, 35 years ago tomorrow. Reagan was shocked, but not surprised, although he hadn't known much about the problem in his diary. That fellow Begin makes it very hard for us to support Israel. So he thought that Israel should have told the U.S. and the French, and maybe something could have been done diplomatically. He didn't know, the Carter administration never briefed Reagan or his aides, that Israel had made such appeals to Carter, and they had fallen on deaf ears, as Israel had used American planes in an offensive strike. Reagan had to suspend the shipment of four F-16s to Israel. The whole world and the UN condemned Israel, although Jean Kirkpatrick prevented the UN resolution from labeling the attack an aggression. Reagan conceded in his diary that he would not allow Congress to block future sales to Israel, and that, I quote, Iraq is technically still at war with Israel, and I believe they were preparing to build an atomic bomb. 2 months later, he released the planes to Israel. 10 years later, it was almost universally acknowledged during the Gulf War that Israel had averted an international catastrophe by unilaterally ending Iraq's nuclear program. So in 1981, a freshman congressman named Richard Cheney, later to be known as Dick Cheney, was one of the few openly supported Israel's attack on the reactor. 8 years later, it was March 1989, or roughly March or April, I was at the Pentagon for reasons I don't recall, and he said in a speech that Israel should never engage in unilateral moves like the attack on the Osirak reactor. So afterwards, I said to him that I seem to recall a young congressman named Richard Cheney of Wyoming that supported Israel's attack in 1981. So Cheney cocked his head, you know, spoke out of the side of his mouth with a half smile, and he said, "Well, I have a different job now." All right, it's a true statement. But in 1991, he gave the IAF general, who was commanding the IAF at the time, David Ivry, a satellite picture of the destroyed reactor that the American Air Force was taking when they flew over Baghdad, with a notation, "Thanks for a job well done." And that's probably the last word on that. The second blip came when Reagan proposed selling AWACS, airborne radar, to Saudi Arabia, which Israel felt was a great threat to its security. It could have been, even though in retrospect it wasn't. Now, the Saudis, make no mistake, are perennial Jew haters. A Jew can't even enter Saudi Arabia till today. But in retrospect, the opening to Saudi Arabia moved it closer to the U.S. as an ally, although not a friend, and somewhat moderate its behavior. It's impossible to imagine that today Israel would have a tacit alliance with the Saudis but for its earlier relationship with the U.S. But in fact, the Israel-Saudi relationship today is based on the fact that the U.S. is hostile to both. It wasn't acknowledged then, but the Saudis wanted the AWACS not to attack Israel or defend itself against Israel, but to defend itself against Iraq. Nonetheless, AIPAC mobilized. It was a big storm, a big fight in Congress. I had a bumper sticker on my car that read, "No AWACS to Saudi Arabia." One aide upped the ante by telling Congress they had to choose between Reagan or Begin, which didn't sound good. Reagan was hurt, and he felt that Israelis and Jews should trust his judgment and that of the Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, who was an outspoken supporter of Israel. In October 1981, Congress narrowly approved the sales, a defeat for AIPAC. But neither contretemps really derailed the warm feelings between Reagan and Jewish leaders. Reagan first met Menachem Begin. He called him Menachem in September 1981, and they charmed each other. Begin thanked Reagan for entertaining him as a young member of Knesset. He said it was a boring debate. He would slip out to the local movie house and see some of Reagan's movies. But when they met in private, Begin was less than impressed, as all Reagan did was read talking points from index cards about American policies in the region, and that was it, end the discussion. But Begin was comforted that Reagan, deep down, was very sympathetic to Israel. It was Reagan that set the level of aid to Israel at $3 billion a year, which roughly remains today, although it takes a different form today. He defended Israel at the UN and was not as vocal against Israel's invasions of Lebanon as other presidents were, criticizing only when he felt world pressure demanded it. And it did happen a few other times also. But Yitzhak Shamir did say in 1988, "This is the most friendly administration we've ever worked with, and this despite occasional strains." It was Reagan who signed a strategic cooperation agreement with Israel for shared intelligence, a reflection of how Reagan saw Israel as part of the American vanguard to thwart the Soviet Union. And Begin, too, had referred to Israel for the first time as America's partner. And again, not as a ward. But that agreement was nonetheless undermined by the Defense Secretary, Caspar Weinberg, whose father was Jewish, and who had almost a visceral dislike of Israel, and that led to the spying of Jonathan Pollard, about which, if you recall, I see it in the diary also, Reagan said relatively little. Relatively little. I didn't find he said anything for that matter. Maybe because the U.S. had long wiretapped Israeli officials and conducted surveillance on American Jews. Despite the warmth of Reagan, Jews reverted to typical voting patterns in 1984. It was then I met Marshall Brager, who was a Reagan aide, became the first Orthodox Jew to serve in the White House, a special assistant and liaison to the Jewish community. So he came to speak on Reagan's behalf in Kew Gardens Hills. His adversary was the hapless Chuck Schumer advocating Mondale's candidacy. Reagan obliterated Mondale, one of the greatest landslides ever, 59-41%. Mondale won only one state, his own Minnesota, 525-13 in the Electoral College. 59-41%, but Jews supported Mondale 67-31%, defining Jews as hopeless, incorrigible liberals. Now, two events would shape Reagan's second term with Jews: the visit to Bitburg and his dealings with Gorbachev that led to freedom for Natan Sharansky, other refuseniks, and eventually the end of the Cold War and the demise of the Soviet Union. In the spring of 1985, as part of the commemorations of the 40th anniversary of the end of World War II, the Allies, former Allies, and the Germans planned to meet to demonstrate the New World Order, how modern, democratic, anti-communist West Germany has rejoined the family of nations and is a close ally of the United States. So German Chancellor Helmut Kohl had the great idea that as a gesture of reconciliation, Reagan should visit the German military cemetery and lay a wreath. The reaction from Jewish and many other circles was immediate. It was a disgrace. Anything that implied forgiveness was just too much. And when it became known within a few days that of the 2,000 graves there, 49 were members of the Waffen-SS, the opposition became even more strident. One of the SS officers buried there, Otto Bagel, had been decorated during the war for murdering 70 captured American soldiers and throwing their bodies in a shallow grave. In fact, from Reagan's diaries, it's clear that he understood the general opposition, but he never mentioned the SS component. And the optics were also bad, rare for a Reagan administration, because Reagan's handlers had originally rejected a visit to Dachau, and then Reagan said that most Germans today were not alive during the Holocaust, so it would be unfair to impose guilt upon them. And he felt that it was important politically and diplomatically to strengthen Helmut Kohl and show the German people that America welcomed the alliance. It was a major storm, Reagan in his diary. Some of our Jewish friends are now on the warpath. Then he said, would Helmut be wrong if he visited Arlington Cemetery on one of his U.S. visits? A White House meeting with Jewish leaders did not go well. Pat Buchanan, who by that time was Reagan's communications director, was seen doodling on a pad, succumbing to the pressure of the Jews. And the issue was not just his SS graves, but the fact that he was not visiting a concentration camp. And then he said at a press conference that German soldiers were also victims of Nazism. Undoubtedly true in some cases, but certainly not in most cases. But Reagan dug in his heels, and he insisted that he could not betray his ally or embarrass him. Elie Wiesel came to the White House with the U.S. Holocaust Commission for a prearranged ceremony, April 19th, 1985, and he gently chided Reagan. May I, Mr. President, if it is possible at all, implore you to do something else, find another way, another site. That place, Mr. President, is not your place. Your place is with the victims of the SS. The issue here is not politics, but good and evil. It was a very dramatic moment. Public opinion in America was split evenly, but Congress overwhelmingly passed a non-binding resolution opposing his visit. In his diary, Reagan called this my Dreyfus case. Bush, vice president, urged him to hold firm. And then a visit to Bergen-Belsen was hastily arranged, but that was panned by the head of a survivors group. I need not add he was a Democrat. And he said, if you go to Bitburg, we do not need you. We do not want you at Bergen-Belsen. And Jews came from America to demonstrate against Reagan. He did speak at Bergen-Belsen, saying in a trembling voice, here they lie, never to hope, never to pray, never to love, never to heal, never to laugh, never to cry. Never again. I promise you we will never forget. He then went to Bitburg, preside over the ceremony, but he did not speak at Bitburg. At the American Air Force Base nearby, a few hours later, Reagan did say to the German people, "We who were enemies are now friends. We who were bitter adversaries are now the strongest of allies. In the place of fear, we have sown trust. And out of the ruins of war has blossomed an enduring peace." Well, the media didn't let up. Thomas Friedman and the Times stoked the flames by citing the anger. Who knows if it's true, but the anger among the Israeli leadership. But Reagan himself was content. Upon his return, he noted 59% of the public supported the trip after it had taken place. America also became entangled in the Middle East during Reagan's tenure, and he swiftly untangled. After Israel invaded Lebanon June 6, 1982, the IDF began a campaign to dispatch Arafat and the PLO. Beirut was bombarded, causing tremendous damage to the city, as well as claims of mass civilian casualties. I say claims because no one really knows. And civilians have been dying in Lebanon since the Civil War began in 1975. Michael Deaver, close with Reagan for decades already, threatened to resign unless Reagan told Begin to stop. Reagan called Begin, told him pointedly, "Menachem, this is a Holocaust." And 20 minutes later, Begin ended the barrage. Reagan, in his diary, "I didn't know I had that kind of power." In September, Christians massacred Muslims at Sabra and Shatila, and the Jews were blamed in the wake of the collapse of Lebanese society. The incoming Christian president, Bashar Gemayel, had been assassinated, prompting the massacre of maybe 800 Arabs at Sabra and Shatila. Reagan sent the U.S. Marines to Beirut to oversee Arafat's departure and stabilize the situation. They stayed a while. October 23, 1983, almost a year later, the Marine barracks in Beirut was suicide truck bombed by a new terrorist group using the name Islamic Jihad, but it's widely believed that it was actually Hezbollah in its infancy. The fact is, all these names are used interchangeably. You know, the Black September, for example, was the PLO, just a made-up name. Iran was also allegedly involved in this. The death toll included 241 Marines. 2 days later, the U.S. invaded Grenada, which essentially changed the topic, and by February, Reagan hesitated at first, but by February, all American troops were removed from Lebanon, but not before a massive American naval bombardment of Syrian positions in Beirut. Civilian death toll from that barrage is unknown. Israel also played a role in the biggest scandal of the Reagan years, the Iran-Contra affair. So after the U.S. pulled out of Lebanon, several Americans were taken hostage by Arab terrorists. Some were killed. The CIA station chief, William Buckley, president of American University, maybe Malcolm Kerr. Why is he in the news? Malcolm Kerr, his son Steve Kerr, coaches the Warriors. So they were both murdered. Five others were still alive. It was suggested to Reagan that the hostages could be freed if Iran was softened up, softened by providing them with defensive weapons, which of course was illegal because Iran was on America's terror watch list. So the plan was, and this is what they did for a while, Israel covertly shipped anti-tank missiles to Iran for Iran to use in its decade-long war against Iraq. It was a decade long, but still too short. And then Israel's supplies would be replenished by the U.S. So in effect, the U.S. did not deal directly with Iran, and some hostages were freed. At a later stage, money from that sale of weapons was diverted to support the Contras fighting for freedom in Nicaragua against the Marxist government, but something also prohibited by congressional legislation. It all blew up. Reagan said he was unaware of the second part, and he did not construe the first part as trading arms for hostages. Nonetheless, a commission was formed. John Tower headed it, and the commission found that it was arms for hostages, and Reagan, gracious as ever, said in a nationally televised speech, "I've studied the board's report. Its findings are honest, convincing, and highly critical, and I accept them. First, let me say I take full responsibility for my own actions and for those of my administration. As angry as I may be about activities undertaken without my knowledge, I am still accountable for those activities. As disappointed as I may be in some who serve me, I am still the one who must answer to the American people for this behavior. And as personally distasteful as I find secret bank accounts and diverted funds, well, as the Navy would say, this happened on my watch. Let's start with the part that is the most controversial. A few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. My heart and my best intentions still tell me that's true, but the facts and the evidence tell me it is not. As the Tower Board reported, what began as a strategic opening to Iran deteriorated in its implementation into trading arms for hostages. This runs counter to my own beliefs, to administration policy, and to the original strategy we had in mind. The reasons why it happened, but no excuses. It was a mistake. And he concluded, now, what should happen when you make a mistake is this. You take your knocks, you learn your lessons, and then you move on. That's the healthiest way to deal with a problem. You know, by the time you reach my age, meaning his age, you've made plenty of mistakes. And if you've lived your life properly, so you learn. You put things in perspective. You pull your energies together. You change. You go forward. I think it's the last time a president gave such a speech. And you'll notice that Israel was not mentioned at all. An Israeli official involved in the Iran-Contra affair, Amiram Nir, mysteriously died in a plane crash over Mexico in November 1988. His apartment was then again mysteriously ransacked in Israel, and all documents relating to this event were taken. His widow is now married to a Silvan Shalom, former Likud MK. Right before Reagan's presidency ended, Arafat announced he was renouncing terrorism, as I recall it vividly. He actually said tourism, not terrorism. And he said he's accepting UN Resolution 242, and with that, the U.S. recognized the PLO. But ties were frozen the next year when Arafat failed to condemn terrorist attacks on Israel. His standing in Washington would only be revived during the Clinton administration. Maybe Reagan's crowning foreign policy achievement was in his dealings with the Soviet Union. Three Soviet leaders, Brezhnev, Chernenko, Andropov, died while Reagan was president, in fact, in his first term. And the fourth, Mikhail Gorbachev, transformed the world order. Now, the first three had all been quite repressive towards Soviet Jews. Emigration was a trickle in the early 1980s. Both secretaries of state, Haig and then George Shultz, both very supportive of Israel and Jews, favored quiet but sustained diplomacy. But by 1985, there were signs that the Soviet Union was imploding, its economy stagnant, its resources unable to feed its people, and its global reach unsustainable. So Gorbachev started as repressive as the others, but he softened when he realized the problems. And Reagan, in all his dealings with Soviet leaders, made emigration of Jews and human rights a major focus, even if he kept it private so as to allow the Soviets to save face and do it at their own pace. That eventually paid dividends. It was Reagan who pressured Gorbachev to free Natan Sharansky, and he was released February 11, 1986, at the Gleinecke Bridge in Berlin as part of a 9-person spy swap. Later that year, 86, Sharansky visited Reagan at the White House, and he was effusive in his praise. And it was Reagan who encouraged the massive Soviet Jewry rally in Washington, Sunday, December 6, 1987, 24 hours before Gorbachev was to arrive in Washington for a major summit. Gorbachev always resented the pressure to free Jews, and the rally, 250,000 strong, including me, I'm sure some here also, on a bitterly cold day, was used by Reagan to show Gorbachev how much this matter meant to Americans. Vice President Bush spoke at the rally. The next day, one of my daughters, very young at the time, I was gone all Sunday, came back, they saw me Monday morning, and she asked me, did you free the Jews? And I answered, not yet, but we're working on it. Less than 2 years later, the Berlin Wall fell, and soon after the Soviet Union collapsed, and all Jews who wanted, more than 1 million, could emigrate. Sadly, we don't find Ronald Reagan getting due credit for his role in freedom for Soviet Jewry. Reagan left office with high approval ratings, averaging 57% for his presidency, and he remains one of the greatest presidents of the 20th century, even if the liberal professors who compose the unofficial lists continue to downplay his tenure. The Wall Street Journal has ranked him as high as 5th, others as low as 26th. So you see how politics plays a role in this. Reagan died 2004, age 94, after a long bout with Alzheimer's. No president has lived longer than Reagan's 94. His successor, George Herbert Walker Bush, was almost his polar opposite in every way. Bush was born in 1924. In fact, he turns 92 next week. Born 1924 in Massachusetts into a family wealthy on both sides. Walker was, his mother was a Walker. The estate in Kennebunkport was a Walker estate. He had a well-rounded life. His father was a U.S. senator. His son, of course, was a president. Bush enlisted in the Navy as soon as he turned 18 in 1942, became a naval aviator, and was shot down and almost killed September 2nd, 1944, during a bombing mission. In fact, his two crewmates did die. He hit his head on the way when he was ejected, and there was a hole in his parachute as he descended into the sea. So he descended at a much faster rate than is healthy. What's interesting is there's a film clip. It's just serendipitous. There's a film clip of his rescue that you could see at the Bush Library on the campus of Texas A&M. They just happened to be filming when his submarine picked him up. After the war, he married Barbara, attended, graduated Yale, and then he moved to Texas to try his hand in the oil business and to escape his parents. His father was adamant this kid should make it on his own, not live off his money. So he became a millionaire. His father did give him some seed money. And then he turned to politics, acquiring an impressive resume, one-term congressman, ambassador to the UN, a Nixon appointee, head of the Republican National Committee during Watergate, where he was the one who told Nixon he had to resign, ambassador liaison to China, director of Central Intelligence under Ford, and then a failed run for the presidency in 1980, but his nomination as Reagan's vice president at the convention. Bush, I quote at the convention, "I am guided by certain traditions. One is that there is a God and he is good, and his love, while free, has a self-imposed cost. We must be good to one another." By all accounts, and even if we don't have the fondest memories of him as president, George Bush was a decent man, raised with manners, with humility. Famously, his mother became cross anytime one of her children began a sentence with the word "I." It was held to be too boastful. She was fond of quoting the pasuk in Mishle, "Yehalel chazar v'loficha." Well, I don't think in the Hebrew. "Let a stranger praise you, not your own mouth." And that led Bush to an almost preternatural inability to speak about himself and to constantly use the passive tense in such forced ways that it sounded awkward. The Secret Service also loved him and Barbara, just generous, thoughtful, nice people. Just a few years ago, when the two-year-old son of one of his current agents contracted leukemia, lost his hair, so Bush shaved his head in solidarity. Certainly it evoked memories of the death of his own daughter, Robin, age 4, from leukemia so many years earlier, which affected the family the rest of their lives. But unlike Reagan, and unlike his own son, George W. Bush, Bush 41 had no natural affinity for Jews. There were no Jews in his social circle. He probably lived years in Texas without running into a Jew. He felt there was too much Jewish influence in Washington, and he did notice that Jews did not vote Republican. The only Jew he had a long-time relationship with was Robert Mosbacher, who he knew from Texas, and who became his commerce secretary. But Mosbacher's four wives were all non-Jews. That was sequential, not simultaneous. And he himself became a Presbyterian, but that was the Jew in his inner circle. Additionally, Bush was a throwback to the Nixon foreign policy of realpolitik. Cold analysts like Brent Scowcroft on his team. They're into parapolitics, realism, managing the world without changing it, to focus on stability over anything else. See, they all accepted Israel, America's relation with Israel, but weren't always enamored with it, especially when it encroached on their relations with the Arab world. It was Bush's vice president who urged Reagan to cut Israel out of Iran-Contra because American-Israeli interests were not aligned. And the U.S. after a time began selling their missiles directly to Iran, and that worked out well for Israel. But he was also the American point man on Operation Joshua in 1985 that began the rescue of Ethiopian Jews. Bush himself had close ties to oil men who were usually pro-Arab. The worst among them was probably James Baker, who was his old tennis partner when they lived in Texas, who had no love for Jews, and his oil interests alone probably constituted a conflict of interest. It was Baker who infamously summarized a view that was extant during Bush's term, even if not everyone shared it, saying in private at one point in 1992, it is reported, "Bleep the Jews, they won't vote for us anyway." Well, he wasn't wrong about the latter. Bush won the nomination in 1988, and after trailing by as many as 17 points in the polls, he also defeated handily Michael Dukakis for the presidency, 53-46%, 426-111 in the Electoral College, winning 40 states and really basking in Reagan's glow. But Jews supported Dukakis 64-35%. Bush received more Jewish support than did Reagan in 84, but politics being what it is, we should expect no favors when we consistently vote the losing side. And worse, these days we get no favors from the winning side either, because they take the Jewish vote for granted. At Yale, Bush played baseball as captain, first base, good field, no hit. And that's probably a good synopsis of his presidency as well. Good field, no hit. Not many accomplishments for his one term. Bush's main domestic achievement was the enactment of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and his main failure, which cost him deeply, was violating his promise, read my lips, no new taxes. But he presided over the end of the Cold War. It's arguable how much should be attributed to him. It is true, Bush low-keyed the breakup of the Soviet Union so as not to provoke a crackdown. He just let it happen. He rejected suggestions that he visit Berlin in a victory dance. He did not want to gloat and provoke the Soviets, and in retrospect, he was right. More presidents who are more concerned with image than substance would have gone and danced and claimed credit, and the results might have been different. So that too is to his credit, and the Jews were freed. Also, unlike Reagan, Bush was characterized as a moderate because he was never ideological, never. He was pro-abortion, then pro-life. He favored raising taxes, then cutting taxes, then raising taxes. He was more social liberal than he ever let on, and the fact that his core principles seemed negotiable prevented him from ever having a die-hard core of enthusiastic supporters, which every president needs. Of course, he famously challenged Saddam Hussein after Iraq invaded and conquered Kuwait, and after assembling a coalition, he launched air attacks January 17, 1991. Ground invasion began a month later. Within days, Kuwait was free, or as free as it was before. And Bush did not take the war into Iraq. At his urging, Israel was not part of the coalition, and Israel absorbed 40 Scud missiles from Iraq without responding. Free minds can differ as to whether that was prudent. The U.S. did provide Israel with Patriot missiles to shoot down incoming rockets. We now know the Patriots did not work. But 2 years, didn't shoot down even one rocket. But two decades later, Israel had refined the technology, so it does work. If one expected Israel to be cut some slack after the war, it was not to be. Bush and Baker organized the Madrid Conference late October 1991, all designed to solve the Middle East problems once and for all by forcing an Israeli retreat. So Bush was capitalizing on his 89% approval ratings after the war. Yitzhak Shamir was not happy about joining in Madrid, and Israel's two successes were in keeping out official PLO representation and insisting on the revocation of the 1975 UN Zionism is Racism resolution, and that was done. Nothing came of Madrid. The partner of the Soviet Union collapsed a few months later, but Yitzhak Rabin later used this precedent to open up secret and illegal negotiations with the PLO in 1993 that resulted in the disastrous Oslo Accords. And pressure came from other sources as well. Baker was always trying to get a peace process started that would force Israel into a corner. Frustrated by Shamir's lack of interest or trust, he had stated in Congress already in 1990 to Israel, I quote, testifying, "Everybody over there should know that the telephone number of the White House is 1-202-456-1414. When you're serious about peace, call us." If only he meant it, he didn't. To induce Israel to come to Madrid, Bush and Baker delayed Israel's request for $10 billion in loan guarantees, not money, just a guarantee to get a lower interest rate, and they pressured Israel persistently throughout his tenure. Bush complained during the loan guarantee affair, complained about Israel's lobbying in Congress, referring to himself as one lonely little guy against some powerful forces on the Hill. He later retracted that slur. Now, there were Jews in the Bush administration. Bill Kristol in the news now again, Dennis Ross, Paul Wolfowitz, Bob Strauss had come as a Democrat, became an ambassador, others as well. And that already was part of a shift of more right-wing Jews to the Republican Party. One religious Jew, Jay Lefkowitz, served in high positions in both Bush administrations. Now, he's been in the news recently. He's a lawyer now in Washington. He wrote an article in Commentary in 2014, I digress, entitled "The Rise of Social Orthodoxy." It's a pretty harsh critique of the modern Orthodox world, in which he alleged that in large part modern Orthodox Jews observe mitzvot not because they believe in God, but because they desire to belong to and live in a particular community, and this is the price they pay. Do this and that. But the level of observance suffers as a result. And he numbers himself in that group, wherein behaving is more important than believing or even belonging. But all that is for another time. After the war, Bush's approval rating was 89%. Even Ronald Reagan never had such high ratings. It was so high, it discouraged prominent Democrats like Mario Cuomo from running. By July 1992, a little over a year later, it was 29%. Now that's a steep drop in American history. What caused it? A recession, a spike in unemployment, and really Bush's failure to connect personally with the public. He had no base to solidify, and that did him in. He briefly entertained not running again in 92, but he did. Ross Perot entered the race, left the race, re-entered the race in October. He drew substantial support, but Bush 41 lost to a young governor from Arkansas with his own problems named Bill Clinton, 43% to 37%. Perot won an astonishing 19% of the vote, and it's almost clear that he cost Bush the election. Bush's standing among Jews was so low in 1992 that he lost the Jewish vote to Bill Clinton by 80% to 11%. No candidate had received a lower percentage of the Jewish vote since Goldwater's 10% in 1964. So, summary, you have two different men, judged differently by history, the ideologue and the pragmatist, and that is really how each related to Jews and Israel as well. The ideologue, Ronald Reagan, with his favorable predispositions, and the pragmatist, George Bush, who viewed Israel as another problem to solve and wasn't afraid to use the hammer in his attempt to solve it. His son, who had a religious Jewish roommate in college and different approach to Jews, would be different. The ideologue Reagan remains more popular, although Bush has grown in public esteem over the years. But 35, now almost 35 years later, Jewish life in America and the state of Israel looks much different. And that is attributable, at least in part, to the presidents that followed, the world they led, and the decisions they made. All that, my friends, we'll pick up again in the fall. We look at the presidency of Bill Clinton. I thank you all very much.